This week on Trek, Marry, Kill, holodeck, Shakespeare, tickets. Next.
The Enterprise has taken on a life of its own.
I believe the Enterprise may be forming an intelligence.
And is turning fantasy into real life danger.
You're saying the ship is under the control of the holodeck?
Now, can anyone regain control of the Enterprise?
I don't know if we can stop the ship.
Before it sacrifices the entire crew.
It's an earthquake.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Trek, Marry, Kill.
Hi, I'm Brian.
Hi, I'm Diana.
Welcome to Trek, Marry, Kill, a Star Trek podcast that far exceeds simple neural functions. This week, we're continuing to judge some of Star Trek's big swings, and to lend their gavel as a fellow judge is writer Diana King. She writes for Televixen, Geek Girl Authority, and Women at Warp, and previously TV Fanatic, where she's banked quite a lot of Star Trek reviews across the many series. Diana, so glad to have you on. Welcome. It's very nice to meet you.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you for inviting me to be here.
I said before, just before we started recording, I think you're a bigger Star Trek fan than I am, so I can't wait to pull you into this episode that I have some questions about now, 30 years on. But before we get into the episode itself, I like to ask people, how did you get into Star Trek? And do you remember the moment you like fell in love with it?
So Star Trek Next Gen was just part of the fabric of my television existence. It was when it was on, we watched it. If we happened across a rerun, we watched it. And so for me, I didn't necessarily tune in at the same time for the new episodes because my parents wouldn't let me really. And so it was just part of that fabric. It was a show that I always knew it would be there. It would always interest me. I would always have a good time with it up until, I have to give you my exception, I was hugely traumatized by Violations. And I feel like I'm not the only person. That episode, I did a rewatch with my husband years ago. We started right at the beginning of season one, ran all the way. And that was the one episode I asked him to skip. And it's one of those things with using Deanna Troi as the puppy you kick. I can't handle those emotional, like, gut punches. So, I can't pinpoint a time where I fell in love with it because it's kind of like the family that's always been there for me.
I totally understand. It's one of the reasons why Star Trek Picard season 3 was like, whatever story issues I might have had, I'm like, you know, I'm kind of in. They already know that I'm going to finish this and I'm into it. So, great. So this week we're talking about Emergence. It's the anti-penultimate episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, our TV family, as it were. It premiered in syndication on May 9th, 1994. So here we are, the 30th anniversary year of it going off the air, which is absolutely wild to consider when you think, for me anyway. teleplay by Joe Manosky with an uncredited rewrite or polish by Naren Shankar. And it was from a story by Brandon Braga, directed by Cliff Bull, his 25th and final TNG credit. That's remarkable out of all the episodes. That's a good feather in your cap there.
It is really interesting to see how many people built career around multiple appearances or multiple involvements with Star Trek Next Gen. I mean, Jonathan Frakes himself went from in front of the screen to behind the screen and continues with the Trek franchise that way. But yeah, there's so many people who have had those careers.
And Cliff Bull, just like an absolutely old, steady hand in the biz, coming in and, you know, always stabilizing it, getting them, making their days. And by this late in the run, you know, this late in the season anyway, that's usually when they're overrun. So getting the vets in there to clean it out. Patrick Stewart would direct the next episode and then it would be the finale. So, you know, it really was like saying goodbye to some of the vets. But Emergence, described by Memory Alpha as a series of puzzling events on and off the holodeck, lead the crew of the Enterprise to a surprising conclusion. The ship is creating its own offspring. The crew has to assist with the arduous process to ensure the survival of the emerging life form and their own. That's a pretty good description by Memory Alpha. The only real details, if you're only listening to us and you're not watching the episode, first, thanks. I'm sure there are people who do that. But this episode has a train in it, and in the train is filled with a colorful cast of characters. There's a conductor, obviously, but there's like a flapper, a gangster, a cowboy, an astronaut, and then an engineer. And then the real big idea of the episode is encapsulated in that final moment between Picard and Data, where they help the Enterprise basically give birth to this technological life form, basically a circuit, it looks like. I hope this isn't your line in one of your great lines, but Picard basically says the intelligence that was formed on the Enterprise didn't just come out of the ship systems. It came from us, our mission logs, personal records. Now, if our experiences with the Enterprise have been honorable, can't we trust that some of these experiences will be the same?
So that basically, that's my line.
Well, great. Then you'll get to say it again and do it better, and that'll be fine. Because I was just trying to shortcut to this idea that the Enterprise uses all of its systems. That's the big idea, to birth some sort of life form, the properties of which, the intentions of which, the intelligence levels of which we don't know. We're not meant to know. It just flies out of the ship. But do you remember the first time you saw this one?
You know, I believe I do. It's, again, not a very clear memory because, again, like I said, we watched everything and anything that was Star Trek Next Gen when it came on. And I did, when you initially sent this one to me, I had conflated it with Phantasms because I was like, oh, is that the one with a straw in Riker's head? And then I had to go back. I was like, same season, different episode. What I do remember was that mishmash of all those different characters that you just talked about that showed up on the train, and that there were this overlap and this combination of all of the possible holodeck realities that people had been playing with.
It's a really cool idea. And there's a couple of comments later from Brandon Braga and co that I'll read through real quick, but I remember watching this one because I was, 13, I think, and it was like still pretty new at being a teenager. So I definitely had other things on my mind, but I was definitely aware that this was the final season of TNG. And I understood that this is like, oh yeah, one more holodeck adventure. And I remember this one was sort of a perk up I think in retrospect, everyone's aware, like season seven is buoyed largely by all good things. That's why I think a lot of fans feel so great about the last season. But when you get into the detail, the episode by episode, there's quite a bit of stuff in there you can skip. And so, but I remember this one kind of like perking me up a little bit at the time. And that's why I'm doing the show though, to see, do these feelings hold up? does the episode survive scrutiny? But I remember it just being like kind of mildly entertained, but with other things in my mind, and it kind of held my attention in a few certain sequences, the kooky characters and all that stuff, knowing what their ambitions were then, knowing what we know now, it does feel like there's some missed opportunities in here all the same.
Yeah, I think part of my brain tried to give each of those characters a role in the computer. Like they do talk about it. They talk about the engineer and the ticket taker and the mobster being security, but they don't tell you what the farmer is. There's all these characters and you try to figure out who, because you feel like every single person who gets a line should at least have a system purpose.
And they're just sitting around really for the most part.
Yeah.
And our crew's just asking them questions, and our crew's not really making choices. They're not very active. They're kind of reacting, but again, that's the episode, and we're going to get to the grades in a second. I actually want to get an idea. I think it's a question that have you ever had just a straight conversation about, what do you think about holodeck episodes?
I have.
Okay.
Mostly, actually, you know why, though? It was in Strange New Worlds when they did the fantasy episode, episode where there's an anomaly that's taking a story.
Yeah.
That Mavenga's daughter's reading and turns the whole ship into it and then transforms the people into the characters. It was literally in my mind a direct connection to the Merry Men episode, like the Robin Hood episodes. It was like Barclay rewriting the cast of the Enterprise. And that was because Strange New Worlds occurs before there are holodecks. that was the only way they could do a holodeck episode. And that's what I called it. I called it the holodeck episode of Strange New World, of that early Enterprise.
Yeah, you see their purpose. You see how it can be fun and how they're unique to Star Trek. It sounds like you get, yeah.
I think the good holodeck episodes, though, actually do further character development, or like Barclay figures a few things out with his. But with this one, it was also a new entity. Like, it was one of those one-off creature feature. Not that it was scary, but like the creature of the week, which was the birth of the Enterprise's child, who we never see again, as you said, just flies off into space. And the Enterprise doesn't seem to mind this either.
Yeah.
Like the whole process of birthing something, that we don't get a clear, definitive reason why it decided to do this. The intelligence it developed flies off with the child, because it never exhibits that again. It's not like Discovery in, you know, gaining true sentience and becoming Zora,
right? That's
right. Yeah. And so this is, it was very much that side trip of for the yes. crew. And
you're totally right about how it affects our characters. I mean, Elementary Dear Data, that's the holodeck gained some sense of self-awareness just in this Moriarty character. And even though that episode isn't entirely emotional, it does work towards an emotion of Data being challenged in a way he never has before. And the ship is in genuine jeopardy. And I love the reference to Hollow Pursuit, though, with Barclay, because he's using it. It's kind of like using it in the way that Roddenberry intended it, where it's like, you know, live out our fantasies, give our audiences a chance to, they're not just on a spaceship, they're on this, they're doing all these other things. And I maintain that it's never explicitly stated, or maybe it was in the technical manual and I missed it. But like the idea that on these long-term space voyages, space madness is a real thing. And so these holodecks were designed specifically to curb that possibility, which is why in the early seasons, people are like, what is this? Like, visitors on the ship aren't like aware of what the holodeck is. I know it's mostly for the audiences to teach them what this thing is, but I do like the idea of like, it was something Starfleet designed so that people would stop going insane on these voyages.
It was also referenced in season 3 of Picard, where Picard explains to Jack that this is also the last refuge when everything's going all to hell. That this is where people are going to seek solace. They're going to find comfort. They're going to create a familiar environment. And if this is the way they go out big. Jack did question the fact that, you know, we're on emergency measures. Why is the holodeck still running? And that was the reason Picard gave.
My note at the time for that was just don't mention it. It makes it, when you make it text, it actually raises more questions than it answers.
Jack got to play the fly on the wall, though, and the devil's advocate in a lot of ways.
Yep.
The other thing that I like about holodeck episodes is it provides that genre bend. So you're taking you're going away from sci-fi and going more into fantasy. So, and it allows them to have the entire canon of literature. That can be Sherlock Holmes, you can be Dixon Hill, you can do the film noir kind of
absolutely
detective.
Yeah, Dixon Hill. Yeah, mm-hmm. we didn't even mention that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting because Voyager goes in that direction. And I don't think that people would say that all those dalliances in that respect work, or their most memorable parts of Voyager, although I know that people there are fans of that. I just think it's interesting because Deep Space Nine kind of went in another direction with the Hollow Suites, where they are much more puerile and, you know, the darker side. But then also their holodeck accidents were much more horrendous. The transporter patterns are trapped in there and they become these characters. And if they don't finish it, they're going to die. It's like much more dire. But so I don't know. I think there's something always that was charming in a way about the idea of a holodeck adventure, and the hit rate on them obviously is I'd say pretty low across the whole franchise. but sometimes they get used in sort of interesting ways. Again, Hollow Pursuits is one of those. And then to reference another Barkley maneuver, the Nth Degree, where he uses it to build that brain device to interface with the ship. It's established that the holodeck can control the ship. So this episode kind of drafts off of that.
Brian, do you have a favorite character who emerged from the holodeck? Because, like, or even persona, like Dixon Hill would be a persona that Picard put on while on the holodeck.
I mean, it's the easy answer. It's just Moriarty. I love Daniel Davis's portrayal, and that was, and I think that was such an amazing find that it worked. It was great. But I rewatched Hollow Pursuits in the last few years, not for this show. And I thought this is exactly the splits the line of like what someone would do today and how today would treat it as the future would, like, because they when they come in to inspect what he's doing in there, they're kind of horrified to find that he's remade the crew. And it's like, that's bad. He's obviously playing out some psychological thing here. But it's also like that makes sense for even today. I thought that was really nice. But what about you? What's a character that's been on any of the shows? It doesn't have to be Next Gen.
Yeah, Moriarty is my top pick. My second place goes to Minuet.
Good one. Yes.
Right? Because she was only in the one.
Yep.
And she sticks with you. And then the alien consciousness uses it later. Yes. Do you remember when Riker's
future
kidnapped?
Imperfect? Yep.
Right. Yep. Oh my gosh, you might say I'm a fan, but you've got the details down. Thank you so much, Brian.
I'm going through the rundown.
Yeah, of course. And then Da Vinci.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, sure. Yeah, Jonathan. Yeah, exactly. So there's that element. Because I was never a fan of, say, like Chaotica and all that. I didn't.
So drive that, with any okay. of that. I don't. I know we're. I'm jumping ahead to the favorite line thing, but when I copied that line down, and I picked it out as my line for this episode. I turned to my husband. I was like, "Oh my god! If the Cerritos ever had a baby." Oh.
So let's go right off of that. So this episode, that's a great point. That's true. I mean, just Boimler's logs, even if it was just Boimler's logs. The neuroses in there, it would be nuts.
Yeah, it was, and Ransom, like, it would just be the most self, like, yeah. It's strange energies, like, he's this is the most dysfunctional a good child entity ever. And now that I've watched Emergences again, I'm waiting for Lower Decks to bring the Enterprise's baby back just to find out what it turned into, because it's right there. Like, it
emerged as Mariner. Because it's encyclopedic knowledge of the Enterprise D. So.
It's such a loose end, right? And that's what Lower Decks is their meat.
Well, I mean, for Lower Decks, I think it's great fodder for Lower Decks. As a loose end in general, I think it is in a way, but I don't think it should have been. Does that make sense?
How did Starfleet not pursue the baby as it flew off? That is Starfleet property.
Oh, now we're in Best of the Man territory.
Yeah, right?
But just to draft off the, could you imagine if the Cerritos birthed a similar life form? Like, the story originated from Brandon Braga's desire to create one more holodeck adventure before the end of the series. He wanted to do the ultimate holodeck show, and he said, we should do one like we've never seen before. It's a bizarre amalgam of all the holodeck shows we've ever seen. I had in my mind this image of Dixon Hill crossed with King Arthur's court, crossed with the Old West, crossed with modern day New York, all thrown together, and our people trapped in the adventure. This is from Memory Alpha, I'm quoting. I thought that would be neat, and ended up coming up with the concept of the ship developing a psyche, these subconscious elements that the psyche would manifest themselves in the holodeck. And we would have to go in and interpret the symbolism and communicate to the ship through the adventures it's portraying. I think that's too highfalutin. I think that's too abstract an idea. After the, wouldn't it be great if we took all the holodeck adventures and mashed them together? that's the episode, and they don't do that, and I don't know why they didn't stick with that.
Because a train fell into their laps.
The train fell into their laps.
And they, yeah, like, again, also looking at what Memory Alpha had down about how they never had to build anything because they had this cool train.
And they had the Paramount backlot, yes.
Right. So, yeah. and then the costume department, apparently. And so,
yes, of course.
Having the train to sort of pull it all together, they didn't have to actually write an adventure that would span all of those things that he wanted to do. He just pulled the characters in and throw them together like some weird time suction cup.
The train was a reuse from Bram Stoker's Dracula, and although its interior was changed, and like you said, it saved them money. They had a drop in their lap. They just had to do some change the pillow cushions a little bit and all that stuff. But here's my thought: it's portrayed in the episode as the Orient Express, right? So isn't the logical episode then that they're on? The episode takes place on the train and they're doing Murder on the Orient Express with all of their pre-existing holodeck characters. So like Picard is Dixon Hill, you know, or someone else maybe, because Patrick Stewart was obviously written around because he's prepping for the next episode and all that. So his scenes are limited. So like, I don't know, maybe Riker took a crack at Dixon Hill or something. And then they're in there and they have to kind of solve it to get out of there. And maybe what they're discovering as they're trying to solve this murder mystery is that there is something else going on with the ship. I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is you're tired by the end of a long season in the long run.
Yeah.
When I hear that pitch, though, I think of something that doesn't have to require an expensive, because the original script by Joe Manosky was very expensive and all that. And I get that. That's television reality. I just think what they landed on was still not honoring the pretty cool idea that Brandon Braga came up with at the end. So we just have to go with that.
My second choice for best line in the episode was actually that very enigmatic Crusher line where it's just like, you never know who you'll meet on the Orient Express.
A couple other stray thoughts before we get into the grades. So the conductor is played by the Big Lebowski himself, David Huddleston, whose rich Virginia voice, West Virginia voice, I think, it sounds like it was made for the express purpose of saying the word ticket. It's just perfect. It's just great to hear. He has a great voice, great look, great presence. And he had a very nice long career. He passed away in 2016, but congrats. That's great. And then the train engineer who comes in for like three lines and gets shot in the back, played by Thomas Kopatchi, I believe. It's not Kopatch. But he's played seven roles in the Star Trek universe. None of the Secret Hideout era, but can you guess any of them?
No,
I'm just wondering, because it's like you see that guy like with Huddleston, and there's just those that guys, right? You're like, I recognize him. I've seen him in something, but what? And he's been in a lot of stuff, but he's been in a lot of Star Trek. So I'm gonna run down his roles. The train engineer was not his first TNG role. His first TNG role was Commander Mirok on the Next Phase. He was the duplicitous captain of the Romulan ship that the Enterprise came to the rescue of. Remember, that was the one where they were testing out that phase shift cloak and Ro and Geordi get caught up in it. So he's the captain being like, we'll do a muon pulse and the energy beam and we'll get them.
It's not fair when they're in makeup. You can't okay, keep going. Yeah.
Fair for us when they're in makeup, but it's great for them because they get to keep doing parts. So then the next one was training engineer. And then he was the Enterprise B communications officer in Star Trek Generations. And then he was in the episode. He was like the lead of the survivors in the episode, The Thaw. Star Trek Voyager. That's the clown episode, folks, if you don't know which one that is. And then he's his last three roles, Kira Taban in DS9. He plays a Bajoran, and I'm totally blanking on. So is it Kira's dad?
Is Must it Major Kira's dad?
It might be. Or related to her in any way.
And the age gap looks right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then he was one of the Vulcans in Broken Bow.
Oh, really?
He's one of the Vulcans in the anteroom of the medical facility where the Klingon is being looked over after he's crashed. Okay. And then finally, he was one of the sphere builders on Enterprise. So
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Not everyone dude, should know that.
Dude punched his ticket. Yeah.
Well, you were saying a lot of people made their careers, made their bones on Star Trek. And hey, that guy had health insurance for a nice little run there because of Star Trek. So.
He's no Jeffrey Combs. Like he's what, three off of being Jeffrey Combs, but yeah. Pretty freaking close.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Great scenes. Go for it.
I know you don't go in order, but honestly, watching Brent Spiner doing Prospero's Tempest at the very beginning and then having Picard basically say, it's too dark in here to see you. I loved it. It was just like, he's like, but it's atmospheric. He's like, but I can't see you. And I love that scene. The train, that scene in the, I don't know why, but putting the brick in the wall when he's building the foundation, even though a lot of the whole thing is like, first off, a wall isn't a foundation. But when the gangster, the mobster takes the brick and puts it in and he's building the foundation, it's just like, you know what? This could be something great. Like it was one of those moments where, as you said, it was missed opportunities. It was like, yeah. there could have been a real narrative there. Something. Yeah.
That's the Keystone City sequence. Really, the brick in the walls is almost the end of that. The real end is when there's the earthquake and Counselor Troy gets buried in them. But I that was my favorite, my great scene. The only one I had was when they get off the train to follow the gangster into Keystone City, and you know, Data's wrestling with the taxi cab and literally, and you know, and then they're following him because exactly what you said. There's something. You know, especially when you're on the Paramount backlot, that old backlot, you're like, this has got TOS vibes in it. And I like when Star Trek gets weird and you're just like, it's just spacemen going on an adventure and they don't know what they're going to find. And I love that Troy, especially, she's just like, let's follow him. I don't know what's going to happen. Let's just go after him. That's Star Trek to me, is just going to adventure. You know, always looking to the horizon and going towards it. And so
leaning in on the adventure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Any other great scenes?
That last one between Data and Picard. Actually, you know, whenever Brent Spiner and Patrick Stewart get to share a scene, they like it's a contest to see who chooses the scenery better, because you'd think that they would suck the air out of the room for other people, but the two of them are really fantastic together. And I like any scene they do together. So
I have to imagine just being in a scene with Patrick Stewart, and Brent Spiner too, but with Patrick Stewart, especially, you've got a great scene partner right there, because even if he is the alpha in the scene, he's also like, if you look good, I look good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
no, if absolutely. I look good, you look good. So you might as well look good too.
Before that final exchange, though, Data comes in to tell him he's actually going to do the scene with Miranda for seeing the people from off the island from Tempest. And the first thought I had is like, is Data playing Miranda? Because I'd buy a ticket for that.
So. Well, isn't that also in the Shakespearean custom of anyone plays any part? So
yeah,
but I also, just to bring it to that Tempest idea, they're doing a commentary on the show, right? Because he's burying the magic and something's coming to an end. But then that last scene is hinting at, but we're going to the movies because we're looking towards the hopeful future. So I thought that was in there.
New World. That's right. The line. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. But I did have one like kind of half great scene for maybe the wrong reasons, quote unquote.
Sure.
It's the scene you already mentioned where Crusher is after Picard's been injured and Crusher's healing him. Picard, you dumb donkey. He goes, because what happens is Crusher's train program, Orient Express program, intersects with Data's Tempest staging.
Yeah,
that's what the teaser is. And it's a kind of a cool teaser. I'm not going to give it as a great scene, though, because they're just copy pasting Shakespeare. So they don't get the credit. Right. Anyway, the follow up scene is he's being healed and he's asking her, I didn't know you were interested in trains, because he's a man. He's just like, he's unaware of who he's speaking to, I guess. That no, of course, Beverly Crusher is not into trains. And so she goes, I'm into the romance of it. It's the Orient Express. And she explains the history of it and all that and give some factoids about it.
Oh, I actually had that scene pegged for later on the hornier question.
Great. So let's save it then, because I have a finishing thought we shall save for later. All right. Yeah. Best Trek tropes.
Oh, the best ones. I didn't actually feel like this one had a lot.
I like holodeck malfunctions most of the time. Sometimes it could be a bad trope. But if you're doing the ultimate holodeck episode, I guess another holodeck malfunction makes sense. So I've had that.
Yeah,
discovering new life.
Yeah, so that would have been the birthing of a new entity, which they didn't even keep to explore, like, or talk to. You know, what I did like was the nodes that were growing around the ship. The little neural
just the actual device, the iconography or the visual.
The idea that so. In people's brains, when there's traumatic brain injury and they actually damage parts of their brain, as they train themselves to learn to walk or talk again, they're actually building new neurons. They build new neural pathways in order to compensate for the ones that have been lost. It takes a lot of effort and sometimes it doesn't happen all the way, but that's literally what happens in the human brain when it's trying to heal itself. And so the idea that the Enterprise with this new sentience or intelligence was building new neural pathways, connecting the sensors with the warp drive, which is how they jump away from that dangerous buildup of whatever was going to blow them up. Which
Trek trope or that was
a terrible Trek trope. But the idea that the ship had built new connections inside itself made I loved that idea that it was this idea of the ship being organic.
Yes. Yeah. That I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Yeah. And I mean, I'm just going to put it for Star Trek, Shakespeare.
Okay.
because they usually do it well. And also, look what happens. You got to use Patrick Stewart to teach the audience some Shakespeare. So
and
that's
aging. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. When as a teacher of Shakespeare, it's good to use it, put that to use for him.
But the question is if Data could perform it in its original Klingon.
Like, I'm sure he could. Yeah, the date would just the only people in attendance would just be Worf and his date, Counselor Troy.
Right.
At that point in season 7. Yeah. All right. Worst Trek tropes then. I already touched on one of them. Do you have any?
There was so much techno babble.
It was bad.
So much techno. Every other word out of Geordi's mouth was just like really like.
He looked annoyed to be saying it. He looked bored to be saying it. They all seemed kind of tired and bored.
Yeah. It was a lot. It was a lot. Like
What is a magnoscopic storm? What is a theta flux distortion?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, and no one expects you to know because it's there to just play to be that wild card, that explanation that isn't really an explanation. And they didn't necessarily tie the emergence of the Enterprise's intelligence with that storm. They just said, oh, by the way, this happened. So maybe
two tech things happen off screen and then we're only told about it, and it's both those things. The magnoscopic storm, Star Trek Encyclopedia describes as an electromagnetic spatial distortion. Okay, that's a hat on a hat. That's too much. That's ridiculous. But so that gets mentioned in the captain's log, which I'm putting in the worst Trek trope, because sometimes captain's logs are good, sometimes they're great, and sometimes they're this, where they're giving us a key plot point that, like you said, we're supposed to make several leaps of logic from. So there was a storm and the Enterprise was hit by it. And it that caused this power surge maybe. But see, I'm having to do too much thinking. And then the Enterprise warps away because it senses a theta flux distortion, which to me just sounds like another version of a quantum filament from Disaster, which was a completely made up thing to just strand the Enterprise. And it's something that the sensors are not designed to detect.
They had a record of it because they saw it afterwards when they were trying to figure out why they jumped to warp.
Yes. So there's a lot of stuff that happened in the past that's being addressed in the present to fuel the future story. And it's what you said. It just sounds like gobbledygook nonsense. Yeah.
It was a lot of kitchen sink throwing in there. So
wouldn't you just say if it had just been a murder mystery and the Orient Express with all these weird holodeck characters and there's a ship red alert because they're suddenly in the storm and then the storm does something to the program that they're in and they're trapped in there. That's the episode. And they didn't do that.
Actually, even a better explanation for the creation of the new entity wouldn't have been the Enterprise necessarily having a baby, but something in the storm conveying a procreation algorithm that did you like, does that make, to me, it makes more sense than the Enterprise having a baby, because the fact the Enterprise had a baby and then it flew off and the Enterprise doesn't care says to me that
that's when they inserted that Crusher line right at the end. She's like, some species are just designed to make a new life and then they die. And that's what they are saying. All the nodes, the psyche that was forming in the Enterprise, the technology was simply being used for this one purpose, to make this one thing. And then that's it. And then it just stopped being that. And it's like, why not do the version where, remember in the early holodeck episodes, it's like, we can't leave the holodeck. You can't walk off the holodeck. Well, what if some weird thing just walked off the holodeck? It was a real Moriarty. So I don't know there, but I think we agree. There's enough in there to go, what? Why? And it's just, it bogs down the story.
It was like they said, oh, we've only got this episode and then the two final whatevers. And then it's like, okay, we've got six stories. Let's put them all in together and have them all. Like,
or we've got one very shaggy story that we need to put all these things in to hold it up. We got, you know, all these little things to keep it afloat.
But doesn't really.
No, like, I don't think it is. It's another one I had was denying Worf. They never tell him explicitly no, but they kind of treat him like garbage. And Troy volunteering him to go shovel the coal. Data's the android. Data can shovel coal all day. So I don't know. Worf knows how to reverse a polarity as good as anybody. Any other worst Trek tropes?
No, that's a lot. That's a lot for one episode, honestly.
I almost tipped towards, in the scene where Data's explaining, the briefing scene with all the exposition, all the pipelaying, talking about an emergent system, which is, again, it's a highfalutin intellectual idea, and they're kind of making it work a little bit. But if you notice, and as I'm watching the scene for like the fifth time and for our podcast here, I'm like, okay, so here we go. Oh, they're talking about all the biological, technological, philosophical things, but the moment it tips into psychological, I'm like, now they're going to go to Troy. And then they go to Troy, and that's when she gets to talk, is when it's about the mind. And it's just, it was just a little weird. And then her insights are not particularly insightful. It's just what works, because Marina Sirtis is great, is that they make Troy active anyway. So even though she's sitting and asking questions, which is pretty boring, and none of the other dudes thought to do that in the earlier encounters on the train, although Worf does. Worf's like, what is this? What's this puzzle you're putting together? She's also like active. Let's go and follow him and let's make a lemonade out of these lemons we're being given. And so they save it there, but it's also a little weird that they're just like, Troy is the mind person. So that's it.
the Scooby gang was a little bit like off their rhythm on this.
And the problem I also saw was that it wasn't being the idea that Picard presents at the end, that it's that this was kind of born of all of their psyches pulling together, which is a cool idea. 1,000 crew members, 7 years of being together. What comes out of that? What emerges from that? And none of that gets reflected back to them on the train. There's nothing recognizably, and Troy would be the one to recognize that, not because she's empathetic, but because she's the ship's counselor. If anyone else has a finger on the pulse of the ship's psyche, or like, what are the memes, the inside jokes? What's the crew's culture like? She would have some sense of that. And it just seems like a minor missed opportunity in that moment. And maybe go ahead.
Yeah. Which is again, like the fact that they were anthropomorphizing systems within the ship as characters on the train.
Yes.
But they couldn't pull it really together, and it didn't. And, you know, everyone on the train was simply seeking those particles needed to feed and create the entity that they were creating.
And right? You get one little bit of conflict. You get two little bits of conflict because remember the engineer, when he runs in before he's shot, he's like, well, let's mm-hmm. listen to them. Maybe they're here to help.
Yeah.
And at the end, the conductor and the gangster are basically arguing if they're going to let Data help them and all that stuff. And right. But there's no real thing to any of that. It's the only suggestion of a psyche, of a thought process. And it was a little, I don't know, again, just could have been more.
I don't think they proved Picard's point that it was actually created yes. of. Yeah, I think they, the this idea that
you're a successful writer because you just encapsulated it perfectly.
Yeah, Picard made that statement, but I think Picard was wrong. And Data actually, I think, thought we was wrong too. He didn't say anything as he left.
No, he just went,
yeah.
Gonna have to swallow that one. He's the captain. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is again, what leads me to, if the Cerritos had a baby, because Picard's assuming that everyone uses the holodeck for noble purposes. You know, the Cerritos has proved that it doesn't. They don't.
Captain Freeman didn't even know what her crew was doing in there.
Right? And yet she sends the ensigns to clean it. Yes. You think you'd have drones for that. But anyways.
That's what I said. I said that exactly. I said that exact thing. I said, especially the Secret Hideout is obsessed with giving like little Wallies and drones to Discovery, and they were doing that when it was still in the 23rd century, and it's like, where are they? Where's the jizz mop-up drones? Where's the Roomba for the holodeck? You know, it's
yep.
Anyway, okay, the most of its time quality, do you have one or many or any?
Looking at the definition of that one, in this one, it was because they were like traveling through genres, like they had mm-hmm. all the different fashion. I think there's a lot of sort of gender boxing, like the flapper girl versus the mobster boy, guy, man, you know what I mean? It's, there were very gender-fied character tropes.
Yeah.
What is a masculine, like, you know, your engineer, your ticket taker, they were all guys, and you just had the girl with her cocktail in her, you know, in her skimpy dress working on the puzzle, but she wasn't solving anything. Right.
Maybe astronaut was a woman.
Yeah. You don't know. Right. You'd hope so. But, all seven seasons, it was the time. It was the time everything sort of set into what falls on either side of the gender gap.
I had just using the train car from Bram Stoker's Dracula. What's more 90s than Bram Stoker's Dracula? So.
For sure. And the backlot for that matter. The way they shot the backlot. There was like that feel of the dustiness of it. And
oh yeah, well, it's that grimy most of the time. They can never clean that lot. It always looks dirty, and it's like Hollywood, but also dirty. Mm-hmm. Now it's time for the line must be drawn here. Great lines.
So again, my first choice is Picard's line at the end. The intelligence that was formed on the Enterprise didn't just come out of the ship's systems. It came from us, from our mission records, personal logs, holodeck programs, our fantasies. Now, if our experiences with the Enterprise have been honorable, can't we trust that the sum of those experiences will be the same? And yeah, so he's trusting in a lot. Like, I love the line. I love his delivery. I think it's aspirational, which is what Star Trek always has been. It's this idea that if you took everyone's intentions on this ship and made it into one giant ball of sentience, you would get a good sentient individual or entity. And the internet's proved us otherwise since then.
So. Well, not about the Enterprise D.
No, fair enough.
He could be talking about, could the meta commentary be, it's a collection of our seven seasons, or is it our hopes and dreams for the movie? I don't know. I feel like it's all in the air that's what they're kind of drawing on too. I really like that line. I totally am with you. I bump on it every time I watch the episode now because it doesn't fit with what we just watched.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, but I mean, a good line is a good line, and a good line stands on its own. It's just in this case, it stands way over here and the episode's way over here.
Yes. Yeah. It would have been great if I saw the episode he saw.
Good point. You know what? If he wasn't on set for a lot of it, he probably wouldn't have said it with such conviction.
Well, my line, I only had one. Sometimes I have more, but this one I had Data as Prospero saying, "But sir, I am supposed to be attempting a Neoplatonic magical rite. The darkness is appropriate for such a ritual." Darkness is appropriate for such a ritual. It would make a great t-shirt, maybe.
No, it's true. And again, I like what Crusher said, where it was like, you never know who you'll meet on the Orient Express.
Oh, we didn't talk about that, but we're going to talk about that later. But yeah, I like that too. Yeah, I like that too.
And she's just, she's almost foreshadowing. She is, isn't she? She's because she has no idea who they will, but just the fact that their ship, they're on the Orient Express is enough to say adventure's on its way.
Again, she's setting up a much more interesting situation on that train than the one they run into. But the Anton Caridian Award for Best Performance. Who you got?
I really liked the mobster. I did, honestly. Like, I'm, you know what? As you said, in Picard easily, you know, fills his space. And as I've said, Brent Spiner holds his own in all of his scenes. But when you're looking at that crew, and you've mentioned the Huddleston, who played the ticket taker, and yeah, he portrayed, but the mobster was this presence, and then he was an active part of the Keystone sequence. So those parts of it, and he was, I was waiting for him to do more. Because it felt like he could. That character could do more.
Well, he did shoot a guy.
Yeah, could explain. Well, he did. But he could explain more, too, though, right? I felt like if we had had a 90-minute episode, that we actually figure out how these characters are anthropomorphized and what their purposes are on the train, that I felt like the mobster had something going for him. But
who would you put out for me? Who would you put as your Shatner? Which doesn't have to be bad acting.
Right.
It just has to be who you perceived as like, wow, they must have had one take. They really went for it.
The farmer? Like the farmer. Hillbilly? The hillbilly? Okay. Like he had several lines and...
They got a restaurant. You can eat whatever you want.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you can eat as much as you like. And I was just like, what? Like, what is he talking about? You know, so he was this... He was kind of like the non sequitur. Like he was obviously giving us clues as to what the train folk wanted, but
like it would have just been interesting if someone like him, let's say, knew their names.
Right.
Something to tie it to that idea that Picard says at the end.
Yeah.
And just be like that they're just like, well, I know who you are. It's like, and then maybe he gets the facts wrong about them or something.
Right. You know,
He thinks Troy is says you're the android, and he's pointing at Worf or something. You know what I mean? Like it could just be a little off, but just the idea that they have some sense, some awareness to fill in there. Because it's like he says that line about the restaurant, and then Troy and Data just look at each other like, "Oh," or is it Worf? And they're like, "Okay, I guess."
Yeah,
he said that. Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying, and then also everyone who worked on the puzzle. And it was obviously the entity that the child entity creature that was being formed. But it was like they're like, well, you know, they assumed everyone else knew what it was, but they didn't actually say.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyways,
I did like Worf. Worf was a little bit like the audience. They're like, but what is it?
yeah.
What is this?
he was like voice. He was saying what we were thinking like the whole time, right? So that's useful.
What part of this will they teach at Starfleet Academy?
That ships can have babies? It's like, or the whole bit about like, you know, this type of storm is going to cause your ship to develop. Like, is
someone's going to try it? Yes, that would be a Cerritos mission. You're going to you're going to tow this test ship into this nebula where this reaction is going to happen. We're going to see if we can replicate the conditions. And then what happens is that the Cerritos actually winds up getting zapped and
I love
becoming
it.
The experiment. Yeah.
Yeah. Mike McMahon should be listening to this podcast. Are you, Mike? You out there? Yeah. We're pitching you. We're pitching you right now.
I had probably whatever the ability to farm Verdion particles from a nebula. Mm. That seems like maybe under a larger umbrella of like, it's kind of like a video game though. Like how does a nebula help you? It's like, it helps your health. It helps you. Like you can do all these things with a nebula, but yeah. Just kind of an interesting use of them, even though they're not, I'm sure at Starfleet Academy, they're taught about observation, study, research, not using something like a natural resource, but an interesting way to look at things, I guess.
And if you shoot different things into the nebula, do you get different particles?
Can you form different particles? Does getting rid of Verdions deplete or damage other aspects of the nebula? Yeah, exactly.
What? And going back to like Discovery, season 4, like, are you just killing whole civilizations when you're doing this that you just didn't know were there?
Right.
There's got to be an ethical question there.
Yeah, because what you're doing and the ethics of all that, for sure. That it could probably affect many different courses at Starfleet Academy. But yeah, exactly. They're creating a reaction in the nebula. So in doing that, you're destroying elements. And so if you destroy enough of those elements, does it destroy the nebula? Does it cause what are the effects, for sure?
Did you check for signs of life before you detonated the torpedoes? Yeah.
Also, aren't you always like altering gravity in space too? Couldn't have all these weird effects, the vibrations or the explosion, or I don't know. It's like a lot of things to consider. I mean, also space is vast. There's that too. But usually a nebula forming doesn't just form in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. There seems like there'd just be other aspects to it.
What did you say earlier about don't ask the question? It just leads to more questions.
And they didn't. And, smartly, they didn't. I guess I'm just doing it just for this. What would they teach cadets about what you can do? Maybe it's just that.
Sure.
Okay. So then we've been delaying this one. Could this episode have been hornier and would that have made it better?
That scene between Picard and Crusher, like, honestly, what was funny for me was not only are they talking about trains, which is actually a hugely like Freudian phallic thing, sure. But he immediately goes to specs. He goes like, did you know it could carry this many passengers that blah blah blah, and go with this? And she's like, I don't care. She took this symbol of romantic adventure and travel and happenstance, and you're giving me numbers. And also he rolled his eyes when she said romance.
Her voice, when she's like, you never know who you're going to meet, she sounds, Gates McFadden plays her as deflated, defeated. That was a romantic overture she was making and trying to express something she liked about it. Like, he asked her about something she was interested in and she responded romantically and he shut her down. And she responded as someone rejected. And I thought that was an interesting thing to play, a way to play it. But also they were probably so bored with just playing the same beats. And so she was like, well, they're supposed to have a thing and maybe they've already seen the script for All Good Things. So they've got to kind of like lay some of that in there. So I thought that was interesting. But also, you're going to tell me that they explicitly state it, that it's an amalgamation of all the crew's various holodeck programs. Are you telling me that 1,000 people, these are the least sexual human beings or varied alien races to ever exist, that there's no sexual component, there's no dominatrix or, there's no kink program in there or something or whatever.
That's the Cerritos you're thinking of again. The Enterprise has noble interactions with the Enterprise.
1,000 people lockstep? They just eat cornflakes and go to bed at 8? That's all of them? I don't believe it.
And what you just said, I just realized that the entire crew of the train was human.
Yes.
There were no other species represented there. So that's a statement of its time. Because
maybe,
That would indicate that Worf doesn't have any Trek program.
Well, that would see that would have been awesome if they had brought that Skeletor fighting beast back. That was, but it was like talking, like he was like Don Draper just sitting in the train car drinking a martini or something. That would have been an interesting. That would have been weird, and it would have been like, what's going on here?
That train needed a couple of Mark Twains on it too.
And then
the only moment of possible horniness was between Picard and Crusher, and so for an episode that is predominantly on the holodeck, there was a lot of potential for sex.
But there's not even tech horniness because what really happened was, if you think about it, is that the Enterprise got pregnant.
And it was a sexless baby making process. Yep.
And even Data treats it like a Protestant. When he goes in that scene with Picard at the end, he goes, after we help the entity complete its process. Is it process? He's like basically complete. It's what it was, giving birth. And, they're trying to minimize what happened there, but it's all there in the text. The Cerritos Mariner would be rubbing the bulkhead going like, yeah, baby, hope you had a good time.
Yeah.
You ready to go again?
If it was an impregnation, again, I feel like it would have been a better story if it was just that Storm was an entity that was reprocreating through an algorithm that it infected the computer with.
Yeah.
Like that would have made more biological sense, especially in the sense of now that it's almost like a incubus, incubator, where it was just like it dropped in, it used the system to create the new life, and then it's done.
Yeah, it's a version of the child, mm-hmm, which in that case, right? Though, it used Counselor Troy. But, in this case, it would be the ship. It would be that. And I'm fine with recycling ideas, but if you do them differently, it doesn't happen all the time. You can do that.
Yeah.
No problem. All right. But let's talk about emergence. Trek, marry, or kill Diana King?
It doesn't fall into Trek or marry. So
I'm with you. It's a kill.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. The 13-year-old me was like, this is fine. I kind of liked it. And now I'm like, no.
As Trek goes, it's entertaining. And the first time we watch it, especially Next Gen, and it might fall in the same way when we review Strange New Worlds 20, 30 years down the road. But the first time is going to always be the first time. And you're going to accept it because you're a Trekker and you love it. And you these are the characters you enjoy. And especially at this point in season 7, you're going to be like, oh yeah, they get a blank check for whatever they want to show me because I've only got a few episodes left and I'm going to cherish them. But to critically look at what's going on here is like, this was a lot and none of it really stuck to the wall.
So this was a big swing that didn't work. And sometimes when you swing for the fences, you'll swing and miss. And
still fun, though. I mean, the stuff we kill is still fun. It's
That's what we say. It's still Star Trek. We don't discourage people from watching them. But, if you have to make a playlist, do people still put iPod playlists together? Because you can do that with video now. Everything's device big enough. This would not be one I would recommend storing on a hard drive to bring with you, but otherwise if you come across it, there's chunks in there, there's bits in there you'll like.
It's not like outright insulting. I'm just trying to remember the episode, Code of Honor.
It's not offensive.
It's not offensive. I mean, like, Code of Honor,
Spock's
if you
brain
to, yeah we, right
Kristen and I were like, maybe this will just be like too kitschy and whatever. And it's like, oh, it's actually very misogynistic and it's kind of like weird. Like it doesn't really go anywhere. This is not that. In fact, emergence, it started from a good, well-intentioned, noble place. So in that sense, like Picard says, their intentions were honorable. And so I don't think it was. So even though I think you just let it go and you don't bother following it, you're just like, it's gone. Great. It happened. I watched it. All right, Diana, you again have a massive body of work, but right now, is there anything you want to promote that you want people to read or see right now?
I hope everyone's loving the current season of Discovery, the last season, which final season of Discovery. It's, we're saying goodbye to our flagship. I would love people to chime in and express their love for it, just because this was the show that launched everything that we have now. And it's going to be a great final season, an adventure, a real adventure. They said like a treasure hunt.
And where are you writing? Let the people know again.
I am writing for the Televixen. My interviews and press days all show up there. My recaps and preview pieces are going with Geek Girl Authority, and I'm currently actually doing Trek literature reviews for Women at Warp. Starting with the graphic novel of the Picard at the Academy.
Okay.
So yeah, and then yeah, any novels that come along, we're taking and giving it a going over on the blog. So
you're that's at Women at Warp to check.
Women at Warp, yeah, for sure, yeah. It's been exciting. Saying goodbye to TV Fanatic was hard, as you can check out my reviews for all the stuff that I wrote on. There were 48 weeks straight at one point in 2022-2023, 48 weeks straight where a minimum of one episode of Trek was out.
I've never heard that figure before, and that's amazing. That's incredible.
There were doubled up ones, right? Lower Decks and Picard at one point had a double up episode a few weeks, and it was just Trek nonstop, and I loved it.
Are you like me, and you're like, I'm gonna stay up until 11:15 and see if it loads early on Paramount Plus and watch it?
When I was reviewing for TV Fanatic, I had screeners. I got them ahead of time. Of
course. Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was again, I'm shopping around where I can review those so I can get my screeners again.
Give Diana your screeners. Get her writing about your show.
Yeah.
I love your enthusiasm coming through. I'm so glad that you came on for this one. I'm sorry it's a kill, but I'm glad that we got through it together.
there's so much to talk about, right? Yeah. Like that was the thing with reviewing too. The episodes I had problems with, I always wrote more about. Because I'm not going to just say that, well, that sucked. It's going to be like, this is the reason there's issues with this. And having you to bounce ideas off of has just been amazing, Brian. Thank you so much for reaching out. I love this.
Oh, I'm so glad. Next week, we're going to tackle another big swing episode from TNG's final season, another 30th anniversary. I'm going just to right to the next one, Diana. I'm going to Preemptive Strike, the return of Ro Laren, Lieutenant Ro Laren. It's a big swing because they're like, how do we wrap up this character? Boy, do they find a way to do that. Thanks again for listening out there. Rate us 5 stars wherever you listen to the show and help spread the word. Trek Mary K-Pod on social media and TrekMaryKillPod.com is our website where you can find all of our Trek Mary Kill standings. And so until next week, TMK out.